Hi guys, I apologize for not having this podcast posted earlier. The file was too big to post on our website, too big to email, so I am re-recording in hopefully just two, but maybe three smaller files to upload onto the webpage. So this is for Module 3, Caring for Children with Alterations in Nutrition and Elimination, including the GI system. Includes the GI and the GU system. The first part of the nursing process with assessment of GI system, we need to find out about the history of the GI system of our patients. Initially, we need to gather baseline data, which includes in our infants, what is their regular diet? Are they formula fed? Are they bottle fed? Breastfed? If patient is on any type of solid foods at all, how often they're eating, how much they're eating, and what their normal tolerance is for their normal diet. For older children, we need to know what type of diet they're on, what their appetite is, what their meal preferences are, and a preferred schedule. Because remember, in the acute care setting, if we are starting to, you know, reintroduce solid foods, we may be documenting that the child has decreased, you know, PO intake, but maybe they just don't like what we're serving, or maybe the times that the meals are served are not the regular times that they're eating at home, therefore they're not eating. So we need to know about their regular diet, regular preferences, what their normal appetite is. We also need to know about history of any prior GI problems for the patient, as well as family history of GI problems, because some of the disorders that we'll talk about tend to be familial, even if they're not genetic. So any history of prior GI problems, history of constipation, history of diarrhea, history of vomiting, and about their regular elimination patterns. How many stools do they have per day, per week? What's their normal pattern, consistency, characteristics, what are their normal toileting habits, GI and GU. So their normal urine output frequency, amount, and even if parents don't generally measure the volume of urine at home, usually they'll be able to tell you if the child has had a significant change in amount of urine output. What's their general nutritional appearance, meaning what do they look like in general? Their height and weight. What's their quality of their muscle tone? What's the quality of their adipose tissue, or the, you know, amount of hydration status in their skin? Do they appear symmetric on both sides? Do they appear to be stated age? Do they appear to be well nourished? You know, what does their hair look like? Frail, brittle hair usually means malnourishment. So what's their general nutritional appearance? We need to do our own physical assessment in addition to collecting history, including, you know, inspection of mouth to anus. The GI tract runs from top to bottom, so we need to start with the oral cavity and take a look at, especially with infants, their ability to suck and swallow. Do they have a coordinated suck-swallow? Do they have teeth, and are they chewing? We need to inspect the oral mucosa. Do we see any ulcerations, any sores? Is there any bleeding or thrush present? Do they have dental caries or any congenital anomalies that change the structure of the oral cavity? Do they have a sore throat or inflamed tonsils? Okay, we need to look at that. If they have pain in their mouth or infection or inflammation, it's probably going to interfere with the way that they eat, which is going to interfere with their appetite and their ability to eat, to swallow, and to maintain a nutritional and hydration status. Okay, after we're done inspecting the oral cavity, we obviously can't inspect too far down the esophagus, so we have to move on to the abdomen. And we want to look at contour. Are they distended? Is their abdomen flat? Is it rounded? Is it scaphoid or sunken in? What's the skin trigger on their abdomen? Normally on kids, that's where we're going to assess for skin trigger, not on their arms and legs like we would with a frail elderly adult, but we're going to check on their abdomen. We're going to assess for any pain, so we're going to palpate. We can measure their abdominal girth if we're thinking that there's an abdominal problem. That way we can assess those measurements and compare them from shift to shift or day to day. We want to assess objectively for their stools as well. That's why when we weigh those diapers, we are opening them up and taking a look. Or if the kids are potty trained, we're having them let us know when they go before they flush. Because we can get subjective data from the family, but we also want to be able to assess ourselves and look for ourselves. So we're counting the numbers. We're documenting how often they're going. We're looking at consistency, color, amount, and we're assessing for the presence of any frank blood. For occult blood, guaiac, we would have to send it to the lab to have that test done, or do the smears in at the bedside. We're assessing for any vomit or emesis. We're looking for color, amount, blood, characteristics. Okay, so we want to know. And just as importantly as knowing that the patient is vomiting is the characteristics of the vomit. Is it spit up? Is it projectile vomiting? Is it half-digested formula? Is it undigested formula? Is it, bile acids in the stomach? So we need to know not only that they are, but the characteristics as well. Urine output, we want to know volume, frequency. We are going to be monitoring those eyes and nose closely. We may send a UA for specific gravity to check for degree of concentration of the urine. We want to look for tears. Does the patient have them? Sometimes with dehydration, and when you're looking at the percentages and classifying dehydration as mild and moderate and severe, looking at tear formation and if they've got tears is part of that assessment. Fontanelles. We're assessing fontanelles on all patients under the age of 2. Posterior fontanelles usually close between 2 to 3 months, so we're not going to be assessing those on older infants. But the anterior fontanelle closes, I know the slide says between 9 to 18 months, but really it's more like 12 to 24 months. 18 months is about the average. It will be closed, but some kids it's not closed until closer to 2 years of age. So we're checking head circumference and we're checking fontanelles up to the age of 2. Okay, bulging fontanelles are going to alert us to neuro problems that you guys will talk about in module 4. But a depression of those fontanelles are going to alert us to signs and symptoms of dehydration. So we would expect them to be sunken if the child is dehydrated. When we were talking about anatomical differences in pediatric patients and the greater body surface area that puts them at higher risk for fluid loss, insensible fluid loss, and lots of extracellular fluid puts them at risk for dehydration and changes in fluid and electrolyte status. So they're more susceptible to dehydration because a greater percentage of their body is water. So if they start to have vomiting and dehydration, they're losing a whole lot of their body percentage in proportion to their organs. So small changes in fluid loss are going to alert to big changes in other areas and systems of the body. Again, signs and symptoms, poor skin turgor, sunken fontanelles, decreased urine output. With kids, we're looking for 1 to 2 mLs per kilogram per hour of urine output. I know in adults, we're looking for about 30 mLs per hour regardless of their weight. But just like with our meds and our fluids, we're looking for weight-based urine output as well. So 1 to 2 mLs per kilogram per hour. Looking for changes in body weight, okay, and in the acute care setting, we're only going to have their admit weight to go by, but we can, hope that they were weighed at the physician's office recently or prior to admit so that we have a baseline and we can assess their response to treatment by increase in weight when we replenish the fluids. We're looking at mucous membranes and lips for dryness, for tackiness, for pallor. And again, we're assessing for tears when they're crying. Sometimes we'll go in and start an IV on a dehydrated patient, which usually takes several pokes because their veins become brittle because of the lack of fluid. And the kid will be crying and crying and crying, and we'll see no tears in the whole time that we're getting that IV started. So we know that that patient is moderately to severely dehydrated. Okay, beyond our observation and our physical assessment and our looking, we also need to listen. So we're going to auscultate the abdomen as well for bowel sounds. For the presence or absence of bowel sounds, are they hypo or hyperactive? We're also going to visualize. Do we see visual peristaltic waves? Okay, with pyloric stenosis, which we'll talk about, you can see visible peristaltic waves. You may also visualize visible loops of bowel if the patient has a blockage. If there's a bowel obstruction or if there's a dilated bowel, like in Hirschsprung's, which we'll also talk about, you may see dilated loops of bowel through the abdomen depending on the patient's hydration status and how close those bowels are to that abdominal wall. Okay, we're going to be looking at their weight, and we're going to be doing daily weights on all patients with suspected GI problems. We're going to look at temperature, okay, because fluid status is going to affect temperature and thermoregulation. Dehydrated patients have a more difficult time with thermoregulation, and the younger the patient, the more immature that system is anyway. So we want to look for changes in temperature, whether they're hypo or hyperthermic, and treat them appropriately. Labs, stool cultures, stool for ova and parasites, stool for occult blood or guaiac, and stool for rotavirus. Okay, so we may try to find the underlying cause. That way we can treat appropriately, whether it's a bacteria or virus or fungal infection or parasitic infection. We're going to be checking electrolyte status for fluid and hydration. Sodium and potassium, we would expect to see changes with diarrhea and vomiting. We're also going to be looking at chloride and bicarb so that we know how we need to replace and replenish to restore electrolyte balance. CBC, we would look at WBCs for presence of infection and a differential to help us determine whether or not we're dealing with an underlying bacterial or viral infection. Eyes and nose, strict eyes and nose. We do them on all patients, but we certainly are going to do them on patients with fluid and GI and GU alterations. Diagnostic studies. Okay, we do x-rays of the abdomen, KUB, which stands for kidneys, ureters, and bladder. But it also encompasses the whole abdominal region. We may do just a regular x-ray, or we may do an x-rays and with fluoroscopic contrast. So we could do barium, whether they're doing it from the top or the bottom. So we would do a barium swallow in things like checking for reflux or pyloric stenosis, or a barium enema if we're looking for Hirschsprung's or intussusception. Okay, think about the types of questions that you would have for the parent or the child, okay, including onset of symptoms, any aggravating or alleviating factors, what was the patient's condition leading up to the onset of the dehydration, the diarrhea, or the vomiting. And then we move on to signs and symptoms by system. So neurologically, what changes would we expect to see with a patient who's dehydrated? Okay, changes in level of consciousness, irritability, lethargy, What other neurologic things? Sometimes the kids, when they're super dehydrated, will come in floppy, decreased muscle tone, decreased activity. Okay, cardiac changes. What cardiac changes would we expect to see with dehydration? We've got fluid loss, so we've got decreased cardiac output, which means we're going to see an increase in our heart rate, decrease in our blood pressure, decrease in the quality of our pulses. We may see a decrease in capillary refill, changes in fontanelles, which you could classify under neuro and cardiac, or musculoskeletal as well. Respiratory status. What changes would we see in respiratory status? Usually tachypnea. Okay, we may see some use of accessory muscles because increase in cardiac in heart rate is going to require an increase in oxygen supply to oxygenate the body for the higher heart rate. So you may see increased work of breathing, retractions, gastrointestinal changes, increased hyper or hypoactive bowel sounds. Okay, you may see an increase in the amount or frequency of stool, genitourinary with decreased urine output. We've got decreased perfusion if we've got decreased fluid volume. Musculoskeletal system, decrease in activity, decreased muscle tone, integumentary, changes in skin. Integumentary, we'll see changes in skin tone, turgor, which again could be under integumentary, or cardiac. We're looking for temperature of skin. Texture, is it dry? Is it moist? Are they diaphoretic at all? Okay, do they have flaky skin because of dehydration? Is there pallor? Are the extremities the same color as the trunk? Or do you notice pallor of the extremities? Does the skin feel cool or warm? When we talk about disorders of the gastrointestinal tract, we're going to talk about whether there are problems with motility, problems with structure and function. So gastroenteritis and acute diarrhea is classified as disorders of motility of the GI tract. Can be classified as bacterial or viral. Okay, usually we're going to treat the same way. We're going to replenish electrolytes, improve hydration status. We're going to place the patient on standard precautions, or we may put them on contact isolation based on the amount of diarrhea that they're having. Good hand washing, but definitely we want a glove. So they may be just on standard precautions with good hand washing or with contact isolation. With acute diarrhea, you may see blood in the stools, mucus in the stools, abdominal cramping prior to the bouts of diarrhea. But we're going to classify it as a change in the number or the consistency of the stools, increase in the water margin, meaning that it's looser, more watery, and usually green in color if there's a lot of bile and the patient has not been able to tolerate foods. Rotavirus has a characteristically fluorescent green color. A darker green is normally from the bile acids. Like I mentioned before, we need to differentiate between vomiting and spitting up. Like I mentioned earlier, there is a difference between a regurgitation and a spitting up of formula that kind of bubbles out of the patient's mouth, and projectile vomiting, where you've got vomitus that shoots 2 to 3 feet away from the patient across the room. And when we talk about the different disorders of structurally in the GI tract, those differences will become important and help us decide which is which. For instance, projectile vomiting is pretty characteristic of pyloric stenosis because of the pressure and the force of the emesis and the pressure inside of the stomach that causes it, whereas reflux may just be a regurgitation of stomach contents up into the esophagus, but it can lead to respiratory problems because it doesn't forcefully projectile vomit and can just be regurgitated into the back of the throat or the mouth and can be aspirated into the lungs and cause irritation of the trachea, the bronchi, and into the lung tissue. Okay, this next slide is kind of a trick question. It says a six-month-old is admitted with dehydration. We would evaluate the effectiveness of therapy by which assessment measures. Select all that apply. And really, we would choose all of them. But we need to discuss what it is about these different measures that we would see as far as evaluating the effectiveness of therapy. So in assessing fontanelles, we would want those fontanelles to be soft and flat. Okay, it says to recall assessment findings for a dehydrated child. So in a dehydrated child, we would expect sunken fontanelles. So if therapy was effective and we were evaluating that, so if therapy was effective, we would expect to see those fontanelles that are soft and flat. Measuring and documentation of abdominal girth, we would assess baseline on admit. And depending on if they were distended, then we would expect for effectiveness of our treatment to be a decrease in abdominal girth. If their abdomen was sunken in and scaphoid, then we would expect for effectiveness of treatment to be that their abdominal girth increases. So it just depends on the baseline of the child and what their initial assessment was. Documenting mucous membrane moisture, if they were dry and pale and tacky when the patient was admitted, then an evaluation that our treatment was effective would be that the mucous membranes are pink and moist. Recording and analyzing INO. Again, we want to use their weight to calculate what their 24-hour intake should be, and then we want to make sure that the patient is taking in at least that for therapy to be effective, and that output is appropriate for weight. Because weight is a good indicator of fluid and electrolyte status and changes in fluid and electrolyte status, we're going to make sure that we get daily weights on our patient on the same scale at relatively the same time of day and in the same state that they're weighed every day. So preferably with no clothes and no diaper to be the most accurate. But if the patient's been weighed with a diaper on admit, then we want to make sure that we're weighing them in a dry diaper as well the remainder of the time. If our therapy is effective and we had a dehydrated patient, then we would expect that their weight is going to increase steadily from admit to discharge. Hirschsprung's disease is the first disease that we're going to talk about. I know you guys did concept mapping last week, so you should know what Hirschsprung's disease is about. We'll talk a little bit about the anatomy and physiology, and also what some of the defining characteristics that make it different from some of the other disorders that we'll talk about. Hirschsprung's disease is a congenital abnormality of the distal bowel, of the distal colon. And it is an absence of the parasympathetic nerve ganglion cells in the distal bowel that are responsible for peristalsis. So those ganglion cells cause movement of that part of the bowel, and so if those cells are missing, then there's no peristalsis happening in that area of the bowel. What happens is the segment proximal to that section becomes hypertrophied because GI waste is not able to pass through that section of the aganglionic colon, so the bowel becomes dilated and full of stool and can essentially causes its own bowel obstruction. So that segment of the colon becomes what we call a megacolon because it becomes so enlarged and full of stool. So what we would see in our patient is abdominal distension, that large visible loop of bowel when you're observing externally. sometimes the mass is palpable, and normally we see this early on in the newborn. And one of the characteristic symptoms is a delayed passage of meconium in that first 24 to 48 hours. That's why in second semester when you guys were assessing mom and baby that we are documenting whether or not the patient is passing meconium. Because if they're not, it can alert us that the patient may have a problem with their GI tract that could be Hirschsprung's disease. In an older child who has been able to pass some stool, because even with a bowel obstruction, I know you guys probably know from med-surg, you can have leakage of more liquid stool around the blockage.